Identity, Who You Are in Christ by Eric Geiger. Chapter 5, You Are His Servant. Quote, you are a people belonging to God, unquote. 1 Peter 2:9, NIV. People love job titles. One corporate executive revealed to me that to keep employees happy, her company is overly generous with titles. The title vice president is attached to many positions. The corporate brass knows that titles motivate people, and it is easy to give a title to someone who is willing to work longer and harder for a new business card. You have attended dinner parties where the first question after you introduce yourself is, "So what do you do?" Perhaps you struck up a conversation with a stranger on an airplane or at a restaurant. If you are really proud of your title, you could not wait to be asked, "What do you do?" If you want to end the conversation, just tell the person you are pastor. Works for me every time. Many people love titles because they find their identity in their title. Their title is more than a description of what they do. In their minds, their title is a description of who they are. My introduction to our obsession with job titles came during my first official job. Besides cutting lawns, my first job was at Bayou Animal Clinic, where I worked for a veterinarian. I took the job when I was 14 to work a few days after school for $3.15 an hour, the going minimum wage at the time. I worked alongside a guy in his 20s who was really proud of the speakers in his old beat-up truck with tinted windows and his name sprayed on the back window. I think he worked just so he could continue dumping money into his truck. The rims and speakers were worth more than the truck itself. When we first met, he introduced himself to me as the kennel assistant. Wow, kennel assistant sounded important. And since I was even younger, I would be the associate kennel assistant. As a 14-year-old, I was excited to know I had a cool title, like associate kennel assistant. After working a few days, I realized that a kennel assistant was a fancy title to describe someone who cleaned bird cages, fed cats, issued enemas to dogs, and picked up dog mess. The dirtiest tasks were delegated to the associate, me. Since we find much of our identity in our title, we tend to drift towards titles that make us sound important. Fancy titles give us a greater sense of identity. They contribute to our sense of self-worth. What title should we be most proud to claim? What title did the early Christians claim as their own? Hi, I am a doulos. In the introduction to their letter to the Philippines, Paul and Timothy introduced themselves by their self-appointed title. Their title is not one the world would expect them to proudly proclaim. Paul and Timothy, two of Christianity's earliest and greatest leaders, introduced themselves with a lowly title. They begin their letter with a statement of their identity. Quote, Paul and Timothy, bondservants of Jesus Christ, unquote. Philippians 1:1, NKJV. The word for bondservant in the original language is doulos, which literally means slave. A doulos is a slave who is willingly bound to another. Hi, my name is Paul, and I am a slave of Jesus Christ. Good to meet you. Hello, I am Timothy, a bondservant of Christ Jesus. What about you? Paul and Timothy could have chosen other titles to describe their identity. Paul could have identified himself as the co-author of half of the New Testament, the most popular book ever written, or one of the greatest church leaders of all time. Timothy could have identified himself as one of Christianity's most influential young leaders. But they chose the title doulos. In the Jewish culture, someone who fell on hard times could choose to sell himself as a slave to someone. If a person was deep in debt, he could sell himself to the person whom he owed money. It was often a wise and logical choice because your master was required to take care of your needs and treat you well. This was not slavery as we have imagined slavery. Masters treated their servants as family. Many viewed selling themselves as servants as a viable option to provide for their family and survive. God instituted a law among his people that the seventh year all debts would be completely forgiven. People who sold themselves to wealthy businessmen would be freed after 6 years of service. God gave instructions to his people detailing how to free servants who sold themselves into service. Quote, "If a fellow Hebrew, a man or a woman, sells himself to you and serves you 6 years, in the seventh year you must let him go free. But if your servant says to you, 'I do not want to leave you,' because he loves you and your family and is well off with you, then take an awl and push it through his earlobe into the door, and he will become your servant for life." Unquote. Deuteronomy 15:12 and 16 and 17, NIV. Servants were given the option to stay with their master, to continue in the service of the person who bought them. Many chose to stay because life with their master was so much better than life elsewhere. They loved the master and his family. They could not imagine living elsewhere. They could not imagine working for anyone else. So the servant could say, "I don't want to leave you. I want to stay." At that point, a special ceremony took place. The servant would place his ear against a door, and the master would take an awl, which is a small piercing device, and pierce the earlobe of the servant. Through this special ceremony, the master and the servant entered into a special relationship, a bond that lasted their entire life. The servant was marked for life as the willing and grateful servant of his master. The marking was important so that everyone who saw the servant and the master together would know that the servant chose to stay and serve. The servant was with his master out of love and gratitude, not obligation. Like Paul and Timothy, you are a bondservant of Christ. Before Christ, you were ruined, bankrupt, and without hope. Yet Christ in his mercy purchased you and made you his own. He bought you not with silver or gold, but with his own blood, 1 Peter 1:18 and 19. He gave you a new life, a home with him, and a reason to live. He marked you as his own through the deposit of his Spirit into your life, Ephesians 1:13. And you stay with your master because you love him. While you serve because you love, you also know that true greatness is found in serving your master. Serving is greatness. One of the reasons bondservants chose to stay with their master was because life was so much better in the master's care. Perhaps sometimes bondservants would reflect on how life was before. They could remember how miserable the nights were, hoping someone would let them stay in their home. They could recall how painful it was watching their children miss another meal. They could still feel the hopelessness and the emptiness. They remembered the embarrassment of wandering the streets at night with no place to go. And life with their master, while not perfect, was so much better, so much more meaningful. Do you remember how empty life was away from your master, apart from a relationship with God? Is not greatness found with your master? David cried to God, quote, "Better is one day in your courts than 1,000 elsewhere. I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than dwell in the tents of the wicked," unquote. Psalm 84:10, NIV. David is saying, "I would rather be a doorkeeper, a bouncer in God's house, than live large in the tents of the wicked, because true greatness comes from serving God." Unfortunately, we sometimes forget that true greatness is serving our master. We often suffer from memory loss as Christians, forgetting where greatness is found and living confused and misdirected lives. In the movie Memento, the main character has an odd medical condition where he has no short-term memory. His wife was murdered and he was injured during the attack. He can remember everything before the tragedy, but since the tragedy, he has no short-term memory. His world is extremely confusing because in the middle of a conversation, he forgets whom he is talking to, where he is, or why he is there. Every few minutes, he completely blanks out and starts over. To cope, he carries a Polaroid camera around with him and takes pictures of people he meets. He writes notes on the back of the photographs, telling himself whom he can and cannot trust. He tattoos important notes on his body, and he references the photographs and the markings on his body to navigate his everyday life. Tragically, he trusts the wrong people and records incorrect markings on his body and on the Polaroid pictures. Because he relies so heavily on the notes he leaves for himself, he makes horrific decisions because he trusted the wrong people. He was marked by the wrong influences. Do you ever live with memory loss, forgetting who you are? Like the character in Memento, we often listen to the wrong voices and are marked by the wrong influences. When we are marked by the wrong influences, our daily lives are tragic attempts to please ourselves. The bombardment of messages telling us that we exist for ourselves contributes to our spiritual amnesia. And the messages detailing narcissistic methods to enjoy life are plentiful. In recent years, one of the most popular books in our culture is The Secret. The premise of the book is that you are the center of the universe and you can attract all good things to yourself through your thoughts. The universe exists to serve you, and the secret is that you can attract greatness to yourself. In essence, you are your own God. So serve yourself. Jesus says the opposite, quote, "If anyone wants to be first, he must be last of all and servant of all," unquote. Mark 9:35. Quote, "Whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first among you must be a slave to all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many," unquote. Mark 10:43-45. God's kingdom is an upside-down kingdom. In God's economy, true greatness comes from serving. For Jesus, last is the new first. If you choose to be a servant now, you will be first for all eternity. If you choose to serve in this brief life, you will be rewarded for all of eternity. Jesus did more than speak about serving. He lived the reality of his upside-down kingdom. He set the example for us. The example of Jesus. The biblical writers Peter and James joined Paul and Timothy in identifying themselves as servants. They opened their letters proudly bearing the title doulos, a bondservant of Christ. Peter was one of Jesus' 12 disciples, so he saw firsthand the example of Jesus. He heard Jesus speak passionately about serving others, and he watched as Jesus lived his sermon. Peter learned from Jesus that serving is fundamentally Christian. Quote, "It was just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. The evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him." Unquote. John 13:1-5, NIV. The context of the story is the Passover, so Jerusalem is filled with Jewish people who have come to offer sacrifices and to celebrate. Jesus decides to have a Last Supper with his disciples. They observe the Passover meal, and Jesus introduces a new symbolism to the meal with the cup representing his blood and the bread representing his body. According to the other gospel accounts, Jesus is having the meal in a borrowed upper room. All 12 of the disciples are present, including Judas, who has already agreed to betray Jesus. If the room were not borrowed, hosts would have been present, and a servant would have been provided. The servant would have been responsible to wash the feet of the guests. Washing feet was reserved for the lowest slave on the organizational chart, the newbie or the youngest. Because of the Passover, There were tons of Jewish people in Jerusalem for the celebration. There were no paved roads. With so many people walking through the streets, the roads were filthy. Nike co-founder Phil Knight would not be born for another 2,000 years, so the disciples did not sport shoes with a swoosh or any other shoes. They wore sandals. Thus, the feet of the disciples were disgusting. Since they reclined to eat around a low table, the odor must have been rank. During the meal, the disciples argue about who is the greatest, Luke 22:24. With the argument as background music, Jesus gets up from the meal. He must have been disappointed because he constantly taught the disciples that true greatness comes from serving, yet none of them stood up to do what needed to be done. Jesus takes off his outer robe and wraps the servant's towel around his waist. He kneels before his disciples and washes their feet. The hands that created the world wash his feet. The hands that fashioned humanity rubs dirt off grungy and nasty feet. God is on his knees cleaning the feet of his 12 disciples, including Judas. Jesus washes the feet of the person who would betray him in a few hours, and Jesus knew it. Yet Jesus kneels before Judas and rubs the dirt off his toes. When he finishes washing their feet, he puts on his clothes and returns to his place and says, quote, "Do you understand what I have done for you? You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. I tell you the truth, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them." Unquote. John 13:12-17, NIV, emphasis added. The Apostle John recorded the account of Jesus washing the disciples' feet. John's gospel is the only gospel that does not record any of Jesus' parables. To John, all of Jesus' life was a parable, a teachable moment, and God washing feet was the ultimate parable on serving. As a follower of Christ, you are challenged to wash feet, not literally, but figuratively. Christ asks you to serve others, to embrace your identity as a servant. He has handed you a towel and has given you a basin. Servants serve. A non-serving Christian is an oxymoron, just like white chocolate, tall midget, fast turtle, and country music. You are a servant, so serve. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. The serving high. Jesus told his disciples that they would be blessed if they served, and you will be blessed if you serve, both eternally and presently. Eternally, you will receive rewards because of your faithful service. Presently, a supernatural high comes with serving. Experiencing God overflow out of your life to serve others trumps anything that the world has to offer. There is a blessing in serving that cannot be experienced any other way. For my birthday one year, my staff gave me tickets to opening night of the Miami Heat season. Kay and I went to the game together. It was an electric atmosphere. The arena was jumping. The scene was in stark contrast to the Midnight All-Stars City League I play in. We are not All-Stars, nor do we play at midnight, but we do love to play. Only a few people are in the stands to watch our games, mainly wives graciously watching our attempts to relive our high school glory days. Sometimes players help prepare the gym by moving equipment off the floor. The refs show up 5 minutes before the game. Yet playing is much better than watching, even on opening night. Before each game, my adrenaline is pumping. I stretch at home, choose my lucky socks, and mentally prepare for the game. While many would say the games were meaningless, they were not to my teammates or me. We were thrilled to be in the game. Playing brings a greater high than watching. In the same way, serving always provides a greater blessing than sitting. Unfortunately, many Christians forsake the serving high to sit and observe. Statistics tell us that the majority of Christians never get in the game. Instead, they choose to be spectators to the work of God. People who opt out of serving remind me of Michal. Michal's story. Michal is married to David, the king of Israel. Together, they live in Jerusalem, and their city is about to change. The Ark of the Covenant is returning to their city. The Ark was a big deal to the Jewish people. It was a big deal, period. It was where God and man met. Remember the chapter on being a priest. The return of the Ark was a significant occasion for the people, both spiritually and nationally. Quote, "When those who were carrying the Ark of the Lord had taken six steps, he sacrificed a bull and a fatted calf. David, wearing a linen ephod, danced before the Lord with all his might, while he and the entire house of Israel brought up the Ark of the Lord with shouts and the sound of trumpets," unquote. 2 Samuel 6, 13-15, NIV. This was a huge day. Adrenaline was pumping. People were shouting. Music was bumping. The king was dancing. The atmosphere was electric because the glory of God was coming into their city. So the entire house of Israel was involved. Everyone was thrilled to participate with what God was doing. Everyone wanted to contribute. Because David was fanatical about music, tons of people played instruments and sang. The Jewish historian Josephus wrote that there were seven choirs assembled before David in the procession. Some carried the ark. Others helped with food preparation and distribution. There were numerous opportunities to serve, and the entire house of Israel was tapped into the joyful celebration. Everyone except Michal. Quote, "As the Ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michal, daughter of Saul, watched from a window. And when she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart," unquote. 2 Samuel 6:16, NIV. Michal watched. She observed from a window while others served. She watched, abandoning the opportunity to be a part of something great. Michal was a spiritual moocher. She was going to reap the benefits from God's presence in her city without contributing. Michal watched the day happen in the comfort of her home, and her day ended in misery. Bitterness fumed in her heart. Is there not a relationship between bitterness and self-consumption? Bleacher Christians are miserable people. Because Jesus knows this, he says with confidence, "Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them." If you do them. How does someone live the reality of a servant? What does it look like to get out of the bleachers and into the game? Number one, serve the master's family. The bondservant chose to stay with his master because he loved him. He wanted to express his love continually through his service because service is the full extent of love. When Jesus washed his disciples' feet, he was showing them the full extent of his love. John 13:1 NIV. The servant's service to the master was often manifested in service to the master's family. Bondservants only stayed if they loved not only the master, but his family as well. Deuteronomy 15:16. Servants would provide care for their master's children and protect the family. Perhaps they would help the kids get ready for school in the morning, assist them with their homework, and check the security of the home each night. Perhaps the bondservant would play games with the family each evening, pray with the family, and celebrate holidays with the family. While God desires for you to serve the world around you, the master also asks you to serve his family, and the church is God's family. By church, I mean God's people, not a building, denomination, creed, confession, or organization. The church is the gathering of the master's family in specific locations all around the world. Wait a second, what just happened? Am I actually suggesting that we invest our time serving the church? Do I have the audacity to equate serving the church with serving Christ? You may be saying, I want to serve Christ, but not the church. I love Jesus, but not the church. If so, I understand. I once felt the same way. Early in my faith, and even early in ministry, I was cynical and frustrated with the church. I remember visiting a church with some friends just to bash their newly renovated church sanctuary. When we saw the expensive chandeliers and opulent decorations, we talked negatively about the church over lunch. They could build a church in the Yucatan for every one of those chandeliers. I remember being scolded by a gaudily dressed woman with bad breath at a church because I painted the youth room for the teenagers. She informed me that the building and grounds committee was upset because I corrupted their beautiful white walls. I complained that if church people's greatest mission was to keep their walls clean, then they missed the entire point of the gospel. When I started preaching, I viewed every sermon as an opportunity to unload on church people for being unloving to the lost world around them. I was convinced that I could be deeply committed to Christ, but adamantly frustrated and opposed to church. Then I got married. God used my marriage to change my heart, not only because Kay seasoned me with some mercy and compassion, but also because I began to understand the relationship between a husband and a wife. God calls the church his bride. God chooses the image of marriage to describe his love for the church. I realized that loving Jesus but not his church would be like someone coming to me and saying, I like you, but I cannot stand your wife. Insisting the church was ridiculous and not worthy of my service would be like someone ridiculing my wife and expecting me to be okay with it. I'm not saying the church is perfect. I know my church is not perfect because I am a part of it. However, I am saying that the church is the bride of Christ, that the church is the family of the Master, and the Master asks us to serve his family. God has given you a spiritual gift, and one of the reasons for your gifting is so that God's family will benefit from your contribution. The family suffers if you choose not to serve. The family suffers if you forget you are a marked servant. Number two, manage God's grace. In the Jewish culture, the master would entrust specific responsibilities to his servant. The servant may be responsible for managing some aspect of the master's business or administering a portion of the family land. The servant would be honored to manage the resources or possessions of the master. Serving is management of God's grace. The scripture reads, quote, each one should use whatever gift he has received to serve others, faithfully administering God's grace in its various forms, unquote. 1 Peter 4:10, NIV, emphasis added. Administering God's grace? Since we are God's servants, he has entrusted us with his resources. We are his stewards, his managers, his administrators. Not only do we manage God's finances, creation, and time, but we also manage his grace. God has entrusted his grace to you for you to manage. When you serve, you administer God's grace to other people. As you serve others, you dispense God's love and compassion. You are the manager of God's greatest resource, his grace, and you are responsible to administer it through serving. So do not take serving lightly. Faithfulness is essential. Number three, enjoy your unique contribution. As God's bondservant, your service is unique. Your contribution to the Master's kingdom and family is uniquely customized to your calling, personality, gifting, and stage of life. In other words, you administer God's grace through your unique gifting. Quote, each one should use whatever gift he has received to serve others, faithfully administering God's grace in its various forms. If anyone speaks, he should do it as one speaking the very words of God. If anyone serves, he should do it with the strength God provides, so that in all things God may be praised through Christ Jesus. To him be the glory and the power forever and ever. Amen. Unquote. 1 Peter 4:10 and 11, NIV, emphasis added. While God's grace is administered through his servants, his grace is administered in various forms. Because we are different, with unique spiritual gifts, God's mercy is expressed in a variety of ways. One weekend, I taught this principle to the people in our church. I emphasized that God's grace is like water, purifying and refreshing, and we are honored to administer his grace. To illustrate, a myriad of water dispensers were placed on the platform. Perhaps God has gifted you to be a sprinkler. You spread God's grace to a lot of people in small ways. Perhaps God has gifted you to be a watering pot. You nurture a group of people over time. Or maybe God has gifted you to be a pitcher. You refresh people with hospitality and tangible acts of service. Perhaps God has gifted you to be a pressure cleaner. You bring change and leadership into situations that need a fresh touch of God's grace. Maybe God has gifted you to be a dropper. You think your contribution is small, but your contribution is essential. There is a unique contribution that only you can make. There is a specific way that God's grace is going to be distributed through you. Each of us plays a critical role in God's desire to reveal his glory through the church, Ephesians 3:10. And your master desires your unique and specific contribution. Check your mark. After 6 years, the master knocks on the room of the servant one evening. The master has put off the conversation for weeks, but knows he must free his servant. He sits down and the conversation begins with an awkward pause. I appreciate what you've done for me, but you have served me for 6 years. You are now free to go. The servant has anticipated the conversation because he knows the law as well. He already has the response formulated in his mind. Master, I do not want to leave you. Where else would I go? I love you and your family. I want to stay with you for the rest of my life. I want everyone to know that I am your servant and I am bound to you for the rest of my life. I am going to serve your family faithfully. Together, the master and servant walk to the tool room. The master takes the awl and pierces the servant's ear, marking him. The two embrace, and their relationship is now deeper than ever before. The marking proves that the servant is with the master willingly, serving out of love and not mere obligation. The master served the servant by adopting him as a family member. The expression of love forever marked the servant. The servant agreed to be marked externally because he was already marked internally through the relationship to his master. In the same way, the foundation of Christ's command for us to serve others is that he has served us. He told his disciples, quote, "Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet," unquote. John 13:14, NIV. What Christ did for his disciples in the upper room is a snapshot of what he has done for us. He took off his royal robes, humbled himself, stooped down to our level, placed himself in a human body, and served us by dying for us, Philippians 2:5-8. Just as the master rescued the servant from a hopeless existence, our master has rescued us. He asks us to serve others in response to his service to us. The early Christians kept calling themselves a doulos in their letters to churches. They proudly bore the title of bondservant. They embraced the identity of a servant, and their identity impacted how they lived. Are you proud to be a bondservant of Christ? Or do you prefer another title? The reality? You are a servant. The response? Serve the master. Group discussion questions. Number one, what would make a servant desire to stay with a master in the Jewish culture? How does this compare to our relationship with God? Number two, what types of messages cause us to forget that true greatness comes from being a servant? Number three, read the story of David and Michal in 2 Samuel 6:13-21. What characteristics of a servant do you find in David? Number 4. How has Christ served you, washed your feet? Number 5. As a group, define the church. Do you agree that Christ desires us to serve the church? Number 6. What excuses do people give for not serving? Are any of these valid? Number 7. Give some personal examples of the tangible blessings that come from serving.